Hello, friends, and welcome to the third episode of a new Marvel Snap podcast, Snap Judgments. As always, I'm your friend, Roy Rogers, and with me today is my friends and yours, Chris Lavin. How are you doing tonight, Chris?
Doing well, thank you. Hope everyone out there is doing well. Hope you had a good last season. We'll talk about it.
We'll talk about that shortly. And last, and definitely least, Aaron Glazer. How are you doing today, Aaron?
I'm feeling bullied, but otherwise I'm doing pretty well. And I don't understand why I was just attacked at the start of this lovely new podcast. And I'm sure our listeners have no idea why either.
Because they can't know, because in the pre-show we were engaged in nonsensical nostalgia that just, you know, brought back the memories of the Glazer that once existed. And, you know, I had to bully you a little bit there. But it is good to be back with you gentlemen after a little bit of a break. And it feels like Marvel Snap isn't even the same game since we last spoke. So how do we want to kick this off, my friends? We have so much to talk about in this episode and in our subsequent ones. So where do we want to start?
So let's start with, we promised last time that we would do a sort of mid-episode on off weeks, but last week in North America was Thanksgiving. Was that last week?
That was two weeks ago.
And what the hell happened?
We had whatever. White book and Thanksgiving and all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Scheduling just was
scheduling,
a
problem. Scheduling, yeah, it was a
good. Okay, whatever. We will be doing those in the future. Sorry about that. Do not assume we will be unreliable. We talk about this game every day. There's very little reason we can't literally record it.
Very true. Very, very true. And so, before we talk about all the big changes, which is like the really exciting reason why we're all three of us are here at 9 o'clock at night EST to talk on Riverside FM. Chris, what was last season? What was some takeaways that you had from last season?
All right, so last season was the Black Panther season, for, you know, just to remind anyone listening. And I would say, you know, in retrospect, Black Panther was a good but not great card. It worked in certain decks. They had some success. Were they the best decks in the meta? Not necessarily, but they were solid. And I imagine better in pool one or pool two if you had the opportunity where on reveal can get really nasty against some of those. The little side event with the vibranium and the like is worthless. It's not worth talking about, so I won't. End of the season, I will give you sort of a, you know, look behind the curtain here. I peaked at 79 with 8 cubes, but did not quite get to 80. And then I finished the season at 74.
Well, I'll go next because mine's embarrassing. I peaked at like 55. I didn't have a huge amount of time to play in sort of the middle of the month. Finished around 50. But Aaron, where did you finish?
I am infinite, which I finally learned to stop calling mythic. I've been calling it mythic literally all week, but I am infinite. I was infinite. Now I'm 72. Okay. But I decided to like snap like it was poker and just retreat aggressively. Like the second I was like, whoop. Playing a Sarah deck, I don't have Sarah or a strong enough presence on 5. I don't even care if it's close and I might win. I'm just out. So I did that, and I like ran from 50 to 80 in like 3 or 4 days. And then I got stuck, and it took me like 2 or 3 days to get to 90. And then 90 to 100 was a bear. Actually, that's not fair. 90 to 95 was super easy. 95 to 100 was a bear. And so Saturday, I just grinded 95 to 100, and I played largely, like, my climb was Sarah Miracle, a bad version of Sarah Miracle that I enjoyed because it played Shang-Chi and Enchantress. And then my last, like, 20 levels were, the token shop had opened, and it was Death Wave time, but we'll get back to that.
Yeah, I was lucky enough on Discord to watch you hit Mythic, Death Wave played a really critical role in your ability to finally get over the hump there.
Yep. turns out She-Hulk is real, real good.
Spoilers. Well, speaking of being a dirty whale at Marvel Snap, Aaron, what else was your other big Marvel Snap accomplishment this in November?
I spent $100. I bought the big pack. So the big pack is basically, it amounts to about $95, $90 to $95. And you get a whole big cyber holiday pack worth of stuff. I'm going to go over what you get from it. I'm going to explain what that value is in terms of dollars and cents. And I'm going to say whether I think it was worth it, really. So you get a new Apocalypse variant along with the, what's the little headshot thing called?
Avatar.
Avatar, thank you. You get 155 bios, which is enough to take that to Infinity Split. You get a 9,500 credits and 3,000 collector's tokens. So the value breakdown for this is it's $100 for 8,000 gold. And this costs 75,000 gold. So you spend the $100 and you get to keep 500 gold, which isn't amazing, but it ain't nothing either. With 8,000 gold, however, you would get 10,000 credits, and you only get 9,500 from this. Although you get them up front, and you get all the extra stuff on top of it. I think the how worth it is largely depends on how you value that 3K collector tokens. It turns out that 3 collector tokens is literally the exact 3K collector tokens that became She-Hulk. So for me, it ended up worth it, because I think She-Hulk, as noted 2 minutes ago, is phenomenal. So, is it worth it? Eh. Borderline, I happened to get a little bit lucky. I got extraordinarily unlucky with my pack openings. I got 4 cards. Rogue, who's good, but not amazing. Helicarrier, which is bleh. Beast, which is fine. And Psylocke, who's pretty good.
Psylocke is a good role player. I mean, you got 2 good role players, a meh card, and what was the other one? So you got Psylocke, Rogue,
Helicarrier, and Beast.
Okay. So you got 3 role players and like a.
I also got 700-ish collector tokens, and just in my general opening, I found 300 more. So that ended up becoming Dracula. So like, I think it ultimately ended up being worth it, but next time we do an episode will be later on this week, toward the end of the week, and there will be those, what are they called?
Bundles?
The bundles that have 2 variants, along with some collector's tokens and credits in order to do stuff for, like, much, 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 much more affordable prices, like $20 to $30. And my general opinion is that those kinds of purchases are easier to stomach. Doing so with $100 both felt kind of nauseating, and then opening 9,500 credits worth of cards
boxes.
Progression packs, boxes, felt kind of amazing and fun. So like, it was a little bit of a roller coaster. I'd rather just do the smaller purchases than the bigger ones.
You'd rather be nickel and dimed.
I'd rather be nickel and dimed. Nickel and dime me. Make me feel pretty.
No, that's fair. I mean, I mean, it's basically the same thing. I think for where I am in my collection right now, I think actually the purchase would be pretty good at like jumping me. Like at the fact that you open about 4 cards, right? Somewhere between 3 to 4 cards, I think.
4 cards, you can buy up to 3 cards with it, right?
Yeah. And I maybe just like selling out $100 is like. I mean, I say this to somebody who's like, his monthly Magic budget is like $200. So like, I'm trying to build a modern deck, but anyway, that's not here nor there. So Chris, do you think you're going to purchase the bundle?
That's a sigh of, I don't know right there. I have gone back and forth between saying, yes, I'll definitely buy it like tomorrow, and no, I'm not going to touch this at all. As Aaron says, it's, you know, this is on the high end of purchases for a mobile game or a video game. I don't know. It's a lot, you know. Is it worth it? By numbers, yes, I think probably it's worth it. But actually doing it, you know, that's, it's a lot. So I would advise people that if you have disposable income and you feel like you want to get a big jump and want to, you know, support the game or whatever in a major way, yes, on the numbers, it's worth it. But don't feel bad if you're not doing it, because
yeah, definitely
a ton.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a whale check, or in my case, a dolphin check. I think actually most of us here are more dolphins than whales. Just to be clear, people who don't know the parlance, whales are huge spenders on games, while dolphins are sort of medium spenders who are willing to make sizable purchases, but aren't like, you know, buying $5,000, spending $5,000 to get the specific Wafu that they want. Oh, not to speak to anybody's Genshin payment plans here. But why don't we move forward to talk about what's really exciting, which is the new season. Aaron, I mean, of all of you, I think you jumped in first to play Silver Surfer. Or Chris, were you also there right at 10 p.m.? Last night, does either one of you want to like sort of jump in and say how Silver Surfer felt? I actually haven't played the card yet, I'll be honest with you.
Silver Surfer is fantastic. It's so much better than Black Panther and Miles Morales. It's completely absurd. It takes previously mediocre cards and makes them absolutely great. It's also super fun because like there's an element of like counterplay and things you can do with it and against it that's like really interesting. I think that so Silver Surfer is a 3/0 card. You get it immediately upon buying the pack for the $10, right? And we'll talk about the value of the pack outside of this one card shortly. This 3/0 card gives all of your other 3 cost cards plus 3 strength on reveal. So you play it on turn 6. It's a 3 cost that's really like cut with another 3 cost a 6 cost, right? Because you almost never want to play it before turn 6 or play with another turn 6. I suppose, unless you have magic in the deck, but I don't have magic, so that's not really a concern for me. It's been very, very good, and it goes with my favorite style deck in the game, which is easily Sarah Miracle. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, well, one place where you might play it before turn 6 is if you're running Odin for the extra trigger on turn 6. So that's a place where you might not play it early.
Or absorbing them.
Yep. I just started tweaking with it today. I mean, it's good, certainly. How good? Too early for me to have a strong opinion about that. But it's good, and it's good in a few different kinds of decks that you can build with it, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So on its surface as a card, do I think it's better than Black Panther? Probably, but mostly because it fits into more deck archetypes. Like, there's a wider range of decks it can be played in. I think that's the big difference here.
Well, let's talk about those. Actually, before we talk about the decks, do we want to talk specifically about whether we think that this pass is worth it? I know that's sort of a little bit of a discussion point on some of our favorite Marvel Snap content creators, because the pass is a little different than it was in the past. The same is also true for the sort of rewards for ranks. So, for example, you don't get a card back this year, or not this year, this month. For hitting infinite, like our infinite player, Aaron, infinite glazer. There we go. Over there. What do you gentlemen think about the value of this month's pass?
Well, I think infinite glazers is the stuff of nightmares, first of all, but, on the pass value itself,
much bullying,
you deserve it. Do I think the pass is worth it? Yes, ultimately. Do I think it's a little worse in terms of rewards than last month's pass was? Probably. It's probably a little worse. But does that bother me over much? Not really. I think there's outsized outrage over it, as is common on the internet. everything is, you know, the end of the world. So is it worse? Yeah, but it's still worth buying. The rework of rank rewards is also, like, it's fine. Card back. I mean, having a Herald of Galactus title is pretty fucking cool. So, I mean, there's some value in that, too. And they also switched the variant to 60 rather than 70. So it's going to be more accessible to more people to get the mystery variant for ranking. So I think that might be, on balance, an improvement overall. So, you know, they're still trying to figure out what the right rewards are, and they're experimenting with it. I think they've said they're experimenting with it to see what people react to well and what they react to poorly. So, like, you know, the pass is a little worse. I still think it's worth it based on what you're getting.
So I want to go over exactly what all this stuff means in terms of better and worse. Well, not better and worse, in terms of what you get if you give them your $10. And this is a pure cash purchase. You don't buy this with gold. So if you do buy it, here's exactly what you get. If you do buy it, you get 1,200 gold, which is in the general vicinity of like $12 worth of gold. But we'll get there. 2,600 credits, 315 boosters, 3 avatars, 7 variants, 4 mystery, or 3 are planned, 2 card backs, and 3 titles. That's a lot of stuff for $10, almost no matter how you slice it. However, certain rewards are free, and it turns out they made almost all of the credit rewards free this month. Credits are the big bottleneck, and they don't want you to have to pay to progress your collection nearly as much. So a lot of the other stuff you get is what you're paying for. So, like, if by paying for it, you're getting plus 900 gold, that's about $12 worth of gold that you're getting on top of the free gold, which, I mean, if you're going to spend any money on this, automatically means that you're getting more in terms of gold, right? Like, you're getting as much gold back as if you had literally just bought gold. So if you're ever going to spend money, you might as well just get a season pass. You're only getting plus 300 credits, which is not really enough for anything. Again, that's where they took it away for. All the variants and avatars and variants are paying. One of the card backs and 2 of the titles are paying. So just in terms of money, it's kind of worth it. But then it's also worth considering, let's say you don't buy Silver Surfer, right? Sorry, my wife decided it was a good time to do dishes. Let's say you don't buy Silver Surfer and you wait a month. Silver Surfer is going to be a pool 5 card that's 6,000 collector tokens, or like a 1 in a bajillion chance of opening at random, right? So, like, you add that in plus the literal your money back in gold, and I think that, and that Surfer's, like, actually good. I think even though you're getting less extra stuff on terms of it, I think the difference in quality between Surfer and Panther likely still makes.
Yeah, I don't, and I think it's important to note
that I'm so sorry. I just, before I forget, Alex Kochia broke all this down in a wonderful YouTube video. His name on YouTube is Alexander Kochia, C-O-C-C-I-A. And I just want to give credit for all that information.
Right, and we'll link in the show. We link to the videos we talk about in the show notes. I know also, like, it's been theorized that by people like Jeff Hoogland that it's going to take, like, somewhere most likely between about 3 months for standard pool 5 cards or series 5 cards to decay into pool 3. So basically, you are basically paying to skip the line on Silver Surfer by about 3 months, maybe 4 months.
Well, but more than that, because, like, even then, there's the chance so hard to get those cards, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, so the question is, like, it's unclear, I think, like, because they haven't really sold us collector's tokens yet, like, what an individual card in Marvel Snap is worth, like, monetarily. Like, you can come up with all kinds of theories, and I'm sure someone can do that whole math, like, thing behind it about, like, what you can theorize. But it's, like, harder since there's not currently a one-to-one relationship. For example, what 1,000 credits is worth. Like, it's no tokens, whatever the collector's tokens are worth, right? So many currencies to keep track of. And that's sort of the stopping point, I think, before we'll really know what the monetary value of the bundle is. Once we have a better sense, I think, as a community of, like, what collector's tokens are worth monetarily. So I still agree with you that that it's just worth it to skip the line on the card, because it just immediately refreshes your collection. But you know, and it's, I think $10 is within the range of supporting the game and getting a card and these miscellaneous like currencies plus extras. Lavin, do you have anything you want to add?
Nope. It is what it is.
It is what it is indeed. Well, you know what this also is? A time to discuss some decks. So Aaron, where is a good starting point for thinking about Silver Surfer in the meta?
So I think there are four and maybe five, because someone came up with a fifth that I threw on here. But there are four different ways that are very clear to think about Silver Surfer in terms of decks. And we'll go over a deck for three of the four. The fourth I'm going to say immediately is Absorbing Man. Absorbing Man is a pool for a card. It's a 4/3. Copy the if the last card you play had a when revealed, copy it. And that is excellent with Silver Surfer. That's still just a Sarah deck, though. And I think ultimately Sarah is the single most important Silver Surfer card. Because Sarah's 5, now 4, negative 1 to all to all of your other cards means you can play 3-2 drops on turn 6 instead of just 2. And that is a humongous difference in terms of board power and stretching out. So I think Sarah is the key card. There's two other sub-things you can do besides your standard Sarah Miracle. You can play Silver Surfer in a Mr. Negative deck for a negative serotonin, a silver negative serotonin type thing, where Mr. Negative is a 4/-1, and all the cards in your deck, not in your hand, just in your deck, flip their cost and power. So Silver Surfer as an 0/3 becomes as a 3/0 becomes an 0/3 that gives all the other threes in the deck plus 3 power, and that's just insanely strong to do that for free on turn 6. And like, you can add Sarah on top of that to make a bunch of other cards cheaper. And then there's also Patriot.
Hold on, Aaron, real quick before you talk about Patriot. I think it's important for why Silver Surfer is powerful with Mr. Negative, because if I remember correctly watching people play Mr. Negative, Silver looks at what your original cost was when you're in play. So that means like if like Silver Surfer himself, right? He becomes a 0-cost 3-power, but he's still, once he's played, a 3-cost character.
Well, it doesn't matter if he's a 3-cost. He doesn't give himself the benefit.
Right, right. But I'm just like
all your other threes.
Yes, but I'm just sort of picking like I couldn't think of another 3-cost character that has that swaps it.
Well, would be a 1/3. So you would pay one and get, or Ironheart, right? You would pay 1 or 0 for Ironheart and still get the +3 on top. Yes.
Well, I think that's worth taking a second here to mention why Surfer works so well in Mr. Negative decks. And I know a lot of creators believe Mr. Negative decks will be the best way to run him, is because there are a lot of 3-cost and even some bigger ones of characters that have very poor strength but incredible effects. If you're reversing those, you take away the negative of of the downside of having no strength. And you're getting a Surfer buff on top of that. So it's a really explosive way. And the cards have powerful effects on them. That's why they're low strength. So you are maximizing the impact of those cards on the board.
I have found Mr. Negative less consistent than most streamers, I think. So I'm a little less sold on this, but hey. The third way is Patriot. Patriot is a 3/1, which is like Mr. Negative, terrible stat line. But Patriot gives all of your cards with no abilities +2 strength. You combo that with either Onslaught, ideally non-Onslaught if you're running Silver Surfer, or much, much more preferably, Mystique, who's a 3/0 who copies the last ongoing card you played. Then she's also giving +2 to these no ability cards. And these two in combination create take otherwise useless cards like Cyclops and Misty Knight and so on and make them extremely strong. But they are 3-cost cards with 4 stat lines, and when you give them 3 strength, and then you realize that a bunch of the cards that they affect also are originally 3 power, then, 3 cost, then it's really, really strong. But it's worth noting, one card that is a support card went from 0 to hero with this single update. It was an okay Patriot card that you fundamentally otherwise basically never saw, but it is now one of the top meta cards, Brood, who is a 3-2 that makes 2 copies of itself with the exact same strength it has gone from kind of crappy to completely incredible. Because both of those copies and Brood will become 3-5s. And 3-5 is one hell of a stat line when you're paying 3. Now you're paying 3 for 15 power in one line, which is just a bonkers rate.
I mean, to be fair, Brood had been seen in certain of the more updated Sarah Miracle decks as well, the Flood variant of them. But yeah. But your point is taken that it is very good in a Surfer deck.
Well, talking about Brood brings us to sort of an archetype that we haven't talked about here. Have either of you played against or seen the Cerebro Silver Surfer decks? Like, what do we think about? Because one of that deck's problem was that it didn't have a backup plan, right? If you didn't draw your Cerebro payoff, there we go. You were sort of like stuck with these mediocre cards like Brood that kind of didn't do a lot. So what do we think about this as sort of strengthening? Glazer wasn't convinced that it strengthened the Mr. Negative archetype, but what about...
Oh, it
what
definitely strengthens Mr. Negative. I'm just not sure if that makes it the better.
Okay.
So Cerebro, just for the record, is a 3-0 that gives the highest cost power thing or things you have +3 strength. And if it's if everything has the same high strength, it's a real big pump across your board. And I'm going to tell you why I don't like Cerebro in one card, and that card's name is Scorpion. Scorpion makes it like if your board is big because you're playing a lot of threes and threes get played slowly, one Scorpion makes your life real difficult for Cerebro.
Do you think that that Silver Surfer makes the deck better, though?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, the deck, I think it's a very cool deck, but, like, you better be willing to sit there and do a ton of math, and, like, it is annoyingly disruptible.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of the more intensive decks to play. It is not the deck you're going to play if you're just sort of checked out watching something on TV when you're sitting on the couch. It's just going to require too much of your attention to do that. But I suspect at the high end, it's going to be very, very, very nasty when, you know, people hit on it. And I think they'll hit more often than you might expect. So I think it's the sort of deck that, if you don't see what's coming and the pieces start happening, once it starts happening, there's very little you can do to stop it, I think.
So, like, one of the common openings, there's a few common openings in the game, but one of the more common openings is Iceman into Scorpion, right? And Iceman into Scorpion makes that deck really suffer. So if you're seeing, and you'll know because you'll have played against this a lot, right? If you are seeing a ton of Iceman Scorpion, then, like, perhaps this isn't a good play. But if you're not seeing a lot of Iceman Scorpion, then the Cerebro version is probably very good. Is that reasonable?
Very good. I think we talked through it pretty well. Are there any other decks featuring everybody's? Do we want that? Our
maybe we'll get to
catching waves. That we want to.
We've got 3 decks to go over, so we'll get to like a lot when we go over these decks.
All right. Well, do you want to start talking about it then, Aaron?
Like, I will just quickly summarize before Aaron goes over things. There is one that's not on his list that I've seen people talk about, and that it's the one I'm currently using because I saw Wong in my shop earlier today, so we'll talk about that later. But I bought Wong in a straight Wong on reveal Silver Surfer deck that's heavy on three costers. Plays no one costs, probably Domino in two, just so you have a play, and then a bunch of three costers and the other when revealed on reveal package. Seems to work fairly well, but I'm early on in playing it, so get back to me in a little while.
So we'll get to why I didn't write that when we get to the third deck. Okay. Let's start with Alexander Cochia, who we spoke of earlier, also in the exact same spot as earlier, has a silver negative deck. He suggests running Bast in this deck, Bast being a pool 5/1/1 that makes all cards in your hand have 3 power, which works reasonably well with this. However, very few of our listeners, including, I believe, none of us, will have Bast anytime soon.
I couldn't afford her when she showed up in my shop.
Yeah, well, I'm in no rush to get her. I think she's very good, but not a priority. So, the non-3 costers in the deck, the 2/2s are Angela, who's a 2/0. Angela was nerfed since last we all spoke from a 2/1 to a 2/0, but that makes her better in a Mr. Negative version of the deck. And Psylocke, a 2/1 that gives you +1 energy. Psylocke is really good on 2 because it lets you skip 3 for the moment and play your 4 -1 Mr. Negative right away. The only other non-3s in the deck are Wong. As Chris mentioned earlier, Wong is a 4/2 that doubles your when revealed, which is obviously completely insane as a 2/4 that doubles your when revealed. And Iron Man, the 5/0 that everyone has from their core set. These cards combine with the following 3 costers. That would be Ironheart. Oh, excuse me, Sarah's also in the deck. Mr. Negative decks basically always run Sarah, because if you can make these insanely cheap cards even cheaper, that's just better. It's also a good backup for when you don't see Mr. Negative. The 3 costers would be Mystique in order to combo with Iron Man and copy Iron Man. Bishop, because you should have the ability to play an absolute ton of cards, with Bishop starting with 3 power is nuts. Wolfsbane, again, starting with 3 power is completely nuts, and you have Wong, obviously Silver Surfer. So this deck is a little... Oh, and excuse me, Ironheart. Because, you know, when you're 0/3 and pumping 3 things with 2 power, that's really nice. This version is lower on 3s than most others. Surfer is more part of a successful plan here than the whole plan. But this is the deck that most streamers, as Roy said, seem to think is going to, like, take over the meta, because there's so many different things it does that it's really hard to deal with. And want to talk about that deck?
I mean, it's a really strong deck. It's got a lot of high roll possibility. And as you said, with Sarah, you've got a backup plan there in case you don't see Mr. Negative. So I think, A, you could retreat if you don't see him, but B, you have a game plan to try and play with. And again, these effects are powerful. So if you're getting, I think I said earlier, if you're getting the benefit of these ridiculously powerful effects while also not suffering the negative side or the downside of terrible strength on the cards, I mean, I think this deck high rolls as well or better than any other deck in the meta.
I can see that.
Yeah, definitely. I think redundancy, like, constructed card games, like, there's, like, a rule of 8 or a rule of 4 where you have sort of redundancy. You want at least 2 different sort of payoff effects in your deck. Like, I mean, again, I come back from Magic, where you can play 4 of a card. You want a rule of 8, right? You want the payoff twice. And Mr. Negative was definitely missing that. Like, as someone who opened Mr. Negative pretty early in my pool 3 life, I found that he just is, like, really, he does, like, you have the way you build Mr. Negative decks, there's not as much, like, if you don't get to do the Mr. Negative thing, like, you're kind of playing like a pool 2 deck that has no synergy. And I think that Silver Surfer really does provide a solid backup plan for this deck. I think maybe I would probably want to lean in a little bit, maybe more than Alex has built this towards that backup plan. But I think that this is like a really solid starting point. I mean, I also don't have Wong, so you'll not see me. I have a variant of this that I plan on playing tonight for my quests that doesn't play the Wong package because just I don't have the cards. So
do you have Brood?
I do.
Yeah, because I'm planning on playing Brood. I also don't have Wong. That's my Brood slot, almost certainly. Mm-hmm. I also think that all of these decks, and my version of this, I opened my version of this just to take a look and see what was different. The big difference is, besides running Brood instead of Wong, I'm running Rogue. And Rogue is why I'm worried about Wong, because Rogue as a 1-3, or what Rogue becoming a 3-3, is an absolutely incredible card. She goes from a card that shouldn't see much play to a card that sees a ton of play, and Wong is basically always the only ongoing in his lane. And giving me a Wong for free when I don't have to play Wong is real, real nice.
Now, I would say the one card I am missing to run this, and I think it's maybe the most important card to run Mr. Negative decks, to just add a little bit of extra oomph, is I'm missing Psylocke. And I think Psylocke, the ability to get Mr. Negative out on turn 3 instead of turn 4 makes an enormous difference in the power and consistency of the deck. So I will not feel entirely comfortable running this until I see Psylocke.
It's entirely reasonable. You know what really hard counters, by the way, all the Silver Surfer and Sarah decks? In case you're having any trouble, it's a nice pool 2 card. Any guesses?
I'm Cosmo bad at guessing. Cosmo
is an obvious one, but...
Yeah, but then that you have to be predictable. There's something else.
I'm bad at guessing games.
Sandman.
Yeah, Sandman does ruin it. Yep.
Yeah, like absolute destruction.
Sandman is an annoying card in general.
Yeah. I mean, Sandman is bad for like things I like, because I don't like playing one or two big things as a general rule. I want to play a game, you know what I mean?
Yeah, actually, if you're going to run Sandman, really strongly consider running Cosmo for another lane as well, because being able to just utterly shut down what they're doing is going to be... You'll get retreats out of frustration.
Yeah, I mean, although, have you seen the Galactus Electro decks that are floating around?
Yes.
Those are a little like, whoa, man. Those are... anyway, we're going to talk about Galactus and such in a future episode. All right, what is the next deck here? So how is everyone's favorite Mistress of the Universe, Death, being treated by Silver Surfer? So what wave is she catching?
A YouTuber named Molten, and again, check the video in the chat, has the following.
The chat, the show notes, Aaron.
Sorry, the show notes, excuse me. I'm so sorry. I'm used to being on Twitch when we do episodes. It is running the Destroy package of Squirrel Girl, Nova, Bucky, Carnage, and Killmonger, along with Debris, in order to basically make Death free. And Deathlock, if I didn't say Deathlock, in order to make Death free. And on top of that, it's running just a Silver Surfer package with a bunch of really strong threes. It's running Brood, Debris is a 3, Killmonger is a 3, and so is Deathlock, along with Maximus and Polaris. And that gives you, like, not only this whole giant Silver Surfer thing, but also just a giant Death to play on top of it. I played this for, I don't know, an hour before we started-ish. Probably a little less than that, but whatever. It's not my favorite version of it, but people don't expect you to be playing a Silver Surfer deck when you start doing all the Destroy stuff, right? So, like, the Silver Surfer is now hidden, and even, like, this is going to make both the regular Death Wave better. It's not running Wave, it's not running She-Hulk. That would break the curve of the last turn stuff, but a free Death on top of all the other things, and the idea that this could be your Arrow Death Wave, this could be the Silver Surfer deck, is going to make both of those extremely hard to play against, and that's, to me, very fun. Pack your armors.
So with this deck, just a spoiler alert for my part, at least, going forward on card evaluations and the like, and we'll get to it when we have another episode doing card evaluations, but The rule of snap seems to be if a card has its cost reduced or provides a cost reduction, it's good. And just sort of stop there. So when you're running death in a package to reduce your cost, that is on its own good. But also with the way this build works, it's got a number of already high strength three cost characters that you are then buffing. So this one, instead of going with some of the weaker strength characters like the Mr. Negative deck does, it goes the other way with things like Deathlok and Maximus and Polaris. And adding the buff on top of those, when you've already got, your Bucky Carnage situations and your death at the end of the game, again, this is one of those just outputs an incredible amount of power if you get it working.
So, mild thing, completely, or semi-off topic, less and less in these decks do I find Bucky worth running, because Bucky is fundamentally a guarantee that if they have either Cosmo, if they have one, Bucky is a 2-1, so you're probably not getting priority next turn, right? And two, if they have either Cosmo or Armor, they're immediately dropping that before you get either Bucky. And, like, I'm starting, like, whereas because the stat line is so bad, I think I'd rather run something like a Nova or a Yondu that I can sneak out and get value out of before. I'm not all the way there. I'm still running Bucky in mine, but like the amount of times Bucky is a dead card because it shows up late in my hand, or because if you're not playing it on 4 with like the immediate Carnage or 5 with the immediate Deathlok, it's so easy to counter is excessive.
I disagree with Glazer, but we can have that fight on a later episode.
Cool.
All right, we can definitely argue about how firmly mid Bucky is, just like the character in the comics and the movies. In a future episode. So what do you think about Polaris in this deck? Like, looking at it right here, like, is she just there because she fits the Silver Surfer package? Like, or is she there as like kind of a poor person's like Magneto, or poor person's Arrow?
I think, like, first of all, strength cost is good here. Three for five is good. What I think I and most of the stat players have gone along have discovered is these cards that have a negative, quote unquote, to pull cards into their lane, that's a positive. That's not a negative. Or at least can be worked around really easily, even in situations where it is a negative. So there's a little bit of extra disruption there, and you've got a good strength body. Like, what's not to like, really?
Cool. All right, let's talk about
Polaris is yet another reason that I've been having trouble lately with Bucky. Because Bucky, and then they Polaris on 3 in another location, and then your Carnage is just looking around angrily.
Kind of like Carnage does in general.
Yeah, well, in general. Carnage pops out and Bucky's in a different lane, and I'm always just like...
We're still judging you if Carnage is your favorite comic book scare. I'm just going to continue to remind people about that.
Although Carnage has a serious claim as the best 2-drop in Marvel Snap.
I'm not saying anything about effectiveness on the board. Like,
I agree.
Now that character, Angela's been
fantastic Marvel Snap card. I guess that's probably still Brood and Mysterio, but like he ain't far behind.
Isn't Brood a 3? Not a 2. What? You said 2 cost. Brood's a 3, right? 3 for 3.
Sorry, I meant what's his dumb name? Mojo.
Mojo. Okay. Daredevil is also pretty good. But anyway.
Yeah. There's quite a few. We'll do, like, at some point within the next couple months, we'll do, like, a top 5 character cards per cost type thing.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about definitely not at all controversial streamer and YouTuber Jeff Hoagland's list, which I watched a little bit of him play before this, while I was eating dinner tonight. And seems like a really solid deck, Glazer. So what do we got here for this deck?
So first, while this person who I don't know is quite controversial, he is also currently, just for those of you who haven't been paying attention, probably the most influential Marvel Snap voice. if he does a video on a deck and you log in within the next few hours, you're going to play against that deck. He is running Domino. I really like that call. That's his only two, because not playing a two and waiting till three to see a card is really, really dangerous in this kind of deck. You can fall too far behind. They can play lots of frustrating cards that will make your life difficult when you are ready to play. After Domino, there are basically 1,000 threes. We've got Rogue, Brood, Surfer, Cosmo, Juggernaut, Polaris, Kingpin, and Maximus and Wave. And then the one card that costs more is Sarah. The Wave being in the deck literally only because if you see Wave and Sarah on three, you can play Sarah on four, and then you just get to play an absolute shit ton of threes for the rest of the game. I think this deck is phenomenal. I don't love the Kingpin tech, to be perfectly honest. I understand why it's there. I understand what it does. I'd rather just run some more value cards in those spots. But, like, and I also don't have Polaris and Juggernaut, so I couldn't do that yet anyway. Those are among the pool threes that have not turned up. But this deck is super fun, and I'm seeing a shit ton of it on the ladder, and a shit ton of it with, a shit ton of that specific, like, Rogue and Kingpin-style play. Just for the record, for those of you who don't have those two particular cards, and I cut Kingpin as well because I'm not running those two while I run Kingpin, I'm running Killmonger, Captain America, and Mr. Fantastic in their place. Because I think all three of those are nice medicals. Thoughts?
I mean, Rogue and... Yep, I mean, Kingpin. The Kingpin tech is pretty sweet. Like, it can do some pretty busted stuff later, like, in the end game, so... I wouldn't undersell it.
Polaris is only killing one thing, so you're really hoping it works with Juggernaut, and then you're likely assuming a 50-50 for death. So I'm not in love with a 50-50.
Okay. I mean, it looks interesting enough. I'm missing Maximus out of it for my own cards to play in there, but that's certainly replaceable with another, you know, high-strength three-cost card. Yeah, I mean, it seems interesting enough. Without playing it, I can't tell you too much about how I'd feel about it when it hits. But at initial look, it seems very solid and seems like a deck I'd be willing to play, unlike the next one we're going to talk about.
The next one is so fun, except I cut one of the cards. Well, two of the cards. Boom, like eight of the cards. I cut the whole deck. What is this version? I'm going to read my version. TLSG has a Patriot deck, but I built my own, so I'm just literally just going to share mine, because I like mine better. So for my Patriot deck, I am running Wasp, Misty Knight, Shocker, Mysterio, Mystique, Surfer, Patriot, Brood, Wave, Cyclops, and then Blue Marvel and Sarah. And the deck has been so good. Hooglin. I've tried like six or seven of these for like two or three games each to see how they feel. This one, Hooglin's, and the Death one have felt the best so far. It turns out that like Wave into early Blue Marvel or early Sarah remains super strong in this version. Wasp is just a phenomenally easy card to play, and the Wasp is going to be 6 or 8 power. 3 or 5 power for 0. That's awesome. And it's just, it works out really, really well. Like, I think that it has been insanely strong. Also, Mysterio seems like he doesn't fit, except he gets the buffs from the Patriot stuff.
He does?
Yeah, so his stuff gets the buffs from Patriot, and I should probably find a way to fit Bishop in this, but I'm not sure where. I'd probably have to cut Misty, and I'm not sure if I'm willing to. But because Mysterio is phenomenal with Bishop, and I'm playing a lot of cards at once in this deck usually. But the deck has been real, real good and real hard to deal with because it spreads a lot of different like powerful effects. effects out. And a lot of the problem with the Patriot decks has been just the atrocious stat line on both Mystique and Patriot, right? You're playing a 3-0 and a 3-1, and if you want to play them in the same location, a lot of these decks are trying to onslaught. If you want to play them in the same location, you're often giving up a location. And that's, like, difficult, right? Like, you're just saying this location's going to be really, really weak. Enjoy having it. And when you've got Silver Surfer, it's a perfectly respectable location. And you're not running Onslaught, so you can spread them out and be less vulnerable to Rogue or Enchantress, who I'm assuming are going to be all over the meta for a while.
So, I have no argument that the deck is good. If you enjoyed playing Kazoo through pools 1 and 2, you will probably enjoy playing Patriot.
I did.
I did not enjoy playing Kazoo, and I don't have any interest in playing Patriot. So this deck is not for me. But if you enjoy playing things and then buffing them all up through, you know, a couple cards that'll probably get Enchantress to once you get there, this is your deck.
So one of the most satisfying things that has happened in this game to me is on turn 6 in 3 different locations, going Patriot, Mystique, and then Silver Surfer after Sarah. It is hilarious watching all the numbers fly up. And you're gonna and because you can do all 3 of those on the last turn, you're gonna make a lot of cubes.
Yeah, I mean, certainly, the better you can conceal it, and the better you can spread out your buffs to not just eat a counter in one lane, the better off you are.
Also, some people are running this. I actually lost a deck because I'm an idiot. I realized what it was. I realized the Wong versions are often running Invisible Woman to like conceal their Wong so that it can't be stopped until the last turn. And so I rogued my Invisible Woman because I was going to Cosmo the location the next turn. Then I realized, since I now had an Invisible Woman through Rogue, I couldn't Cosmo the lane, and Wong ate my face. I should have just dropped Cosmo. I was being silly, and I paid the price. But, like, hey, these are things. If you see an Invisible Woman start getting played in any lane, just immediately Cosmo.
My favorite thing that involves Patriot is, like, this happened to me, or I've done this 3 times, when Sinister London is in my game, which is putting Enchantress in one lane where Patriot is, and then setting it up so it has to copy over into the lane where their Blue Marvel is, and getting both of their buffs and watching their cards go from, oh my god, I've got 40,000 power to power. It's very satisfying. Enchantress. All right. I don't have Patriot, so like it's actually one of the most frustrating cards that I haven't opened. Like I don't mind. I'm not quite Glazer, who's like, me like number go up, it's awesome. But like sometimes playing this style deck can be fun. And I really would like to just have that chance to do it, because like playing Zoo like with Kazar in sort of higher level is not really, doesn't really do it. The Patriot decks are just so much better. So I'm excited to one day open a Patriot and see how this deck could go.
Give you an idea, I had Patriot in my token shop and passed on him because I have so little interest in that style of deck.
Damn. Oof, I would have snap picked. Do we have any more general sort of sense of these decks or like directions we want to take Silver Surfer in the next few days before we are back together to review cards?
I think these decks are going to be consistently really good and really powerful. We're going to answer our next section, just so you know. We're going to answer some fan mail questions, and then we'll call it a day. And our next episode is going to be looking at how Pool 4 and 5 work, looking at what we have thus far spent our tokens on, which Roy didn't even bother to fill out to disc. And
I haven't even seen, like...
Yeah, it's there, I promise. And, but... For the time being, Silver Surfer is going to be a large part of the meta, right? Like, he's a new card that everyone has. If you don't like him and you didn't buy him, you have to figure out how to counter him. And I'm not 100% sure how to counter him yet. It seems like the meta is settling on the counter being those ongoing Destroyer Professor X decks. I don't think that they're a super effective counter, but the meta seems to think that, like, because they run Cosmo and because you can often sneak in that Daredevil to a Thraxa location, that that's going to be the way to go. I lost only one of those games from being that deck for a while, because they revealed first, and I did not realize Brood will not on revealed will not happen in a Professor X location, which I think is being absurd. But yeah, Brood's on revealed just fizzles if Professor X has happened in that location already.
Yep, X is one of those, when it says no cards can be added, it means no cards can be added.
Yeah,
it's annoying. I think that within the location stuff that's already happening should just happen. You know what I mean?
I agree. I think did we talk about that in the show, or do we just talk about that?
I don't know. We talk a lot.
Yeah.
I disagree. I like control. Anything that lets you stuff a lane is fun.
I like control too. I just think that like their unrevealed still happens, right? Like, and they get the timing. I think like that turn, the stuff you play should just be the stuff you play.
I think it should be either or. I don't think it. I think it should nuke everything, like all on reveals, like everything but Professor X's ongoing should just get nuked when he gets played as like a Super Cosmo. Or it should be like it creates like a hermetically sealed lane where what happens in that lane stays in that lane, but it doesn't affect the other lanes. The other lanes can't affect it. Like, I think for me, though, that's like better design space than kind of the weird, like kind of unintuitive way that Professor X like currently works. So, but I mean, different strokes, different folks.
There's a spoiled card that's been showing up randomly when you create one cost lately. It is Ghost, which is seemingly the strongest card in the history of the game. If it actually ever goes live, it's a 1/2. It doesn't exist outside of like random creation, but that's how Galactus and Thanos existed for months and months, right? So it's a 1/2 that when you play it, it has an ongoing ability that you always reveal card second and all your on reveals happen last, which is terrible with Professor X, but excellent in literally every other situation.
It's the most laser card that they've currently have in the design queue. So I'm excited. I bet that card is coming out in February alongside the Kang and Stature stuff that's been spoiled, since that's all Quantumania kind of characters.
So maybe we know how they're revealing the rest of Pool 5. So we'll discuss that. That's part of next week's discussion, how they're releasing cards into Pool 5 going forward. We also know the rest of December's card releases. We're going to get 3 more new cards this December. Again, please stay tuned to next episode if you don't already know that, and we will be breaking that down.
Awesome. So why don't we catch a wave in over to our fan mail, some sort of snaps that were sent by a listener. Tom Bentley, a former degenerate Game of Thrones Living Card Game second edition grinder in sort of southeastern Pennsylvania. He drove me to a few tournaments in New Jersey back in the day and sent us an email. And we sort of boiled down his critical points for some discussion to sort of bring this wonderful episode to an end. So the first sort of question that Tom posed to us is, how do we feel about card progression in Pool 2 and Pool 3, which I think does good a good job of sort of getting the TLDR of some of the stuff we'll talk about in the next episode. So I'll throw that to you first, Lavin. How do you feel about card progression sort of in the mid point of the collection?
Yeah, so I'm about midway through my Pool 3. To give a sort of snapshot of where I am at currently. Anyway, I'm pulling up my profile now, which is really boring for people who are on the listening end here. But it gives you an idea of, like, I'm about halfway through Pool 3. And it certainly does feel much slower now, but not in a way that I have found terribly burdensome. So the way Pool 3 works as a quick snapshot, if you aren't aware, is once you're into the collector's cache range, there are 4 things you can get from a cache. It is a card, a cosmetic, a currency, and something else that I don't remember right now. But the point is, there's four different options. And those, you are guaranteed to get one of those in each set of four collector's caches you open. So the most collector's caches you will go between is seven, which would be if you open the first set of four as a card, and then in the next set of four, if the last one you opened was also a card. So if it's seven, that's going to feel long. But in a general sense, you know, I'm still adding cards. The problem with pull three, I will say the downside to it is if you add a card that's crap when you're going slowly, it is a feels bad. Like, there's just, and look,
just
bad
the
cards
record,
are wait. Card games. There's ample theory about that out there.
My last three cards are Hazmat, Adam Warlock, and Nick Fury. I hear you.
Like, that's god-awful. That feels horrible. But a pull two, I think, is excellently done. Where there are going to be a couple cards you're hunting for still, but the pull two cards, as you get them, many of them do a really good job of opening up either new archetypes or really beefing up an archetype that you'd already played. Pull three has a much wider range, and so you might have situations. You know, you listened to us talk earlier, and we were all talking about decks and being missing one or two cards to be able to run the best version of something. That's just the pull three life. You know, like, you're going to be missing a couple and have to make substitutions or the like to make decks work. So it feels bad when you're getting bad cards, but in general, I have felt like I get cards reasonably often as long as I am playing consistently, and that's really all I can ask for.
In card games, I crave novelty more than I think almost anything else. I like it when things are new, when things feel new, when things feel different, and I don't feel the need for us to all have the exact same cards in the exact same way at the exact same time. Eventually, we'll get further along that path, right? But for the time being, I'm very happy to not have that be how we're experiencing the game. It means that every time I see a deck, every time I find a deck, it's like a little puzzle. And I like the puzzle that is deck building and creating and crafting things. That said, I think they could make it a little less stressful. I think they go a little bit overboard. Not crazy overboard, but a little bit overboard with how slow it can go. And there's also just, like, the getting rid of the boosters in these packs was a very good idea, but I think we're still at probably a few too many useless currencies in the game. So, overall, I think we're heading in the right direction, but I don't think we're where we want to be yet. If you enjoy card games as a puzzle, you're going to enjoy this progression more, even when it gets frustrating, because there's a bajillion decks you can make. If you don't enjoy that, then this isn't going to be for you, but you'll still be fine, because, like, again, a bajillion decks, you'll be okay. I think that more or less covers it.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add is I wish they would add a little bit more directionality. Like, I think the token shop did help with that somewhat, but I wish there was, like, a way to sort of point your collection towards something, right? You know, I mean, like, for example, in Magic, right? Like, if you want a card and it's an expensive card, you can save your money to buy a card. Or, like, if it's, like, $400 for a playset of a card, you can spend $100 over 4 months, you know what I mean? Like, there's ways to sort of, there's not as much ways to, like, yeah, you can save your tokens and wait to get Destroyer, but it could literally be like weeks, maybe even months before Destroyer shows up randomly in your shop, right? Like, I wish there was sort of like a way to pool this, or a rarity system that maybe you could open at like a super booster where some of the like better cards are. Cause like, I do feel like when you open shit, when you're like, oh man, it's a card, and then it's like, oh, it's Black Bolt. I spent all that time clicking the upgrade, and doing my quest to get that blue, and I got Okay. So I think there's a little bit too much feel badsy, but I definitely agree that it's novel and the game designers are clearly obsessed with your inability to solve your own collection to try to fight that sort of ennui that, that like really takes hold of card games like Magic and Hearthstone. So, I'm interested to see where we go, but we should probably move on to the next question, which is, well, we've already sort of talked about the frustration of not getting cards. So I'll just sort of answer this real quick. The tokens do, collector tokens do provide a solution to that. For example, I just got Arlem Zola in my shop, who I'm about to pick by. And that's a card that I've wanted for a while. So I'm excited to have gotten that card right there. Anyone else want to add anything about collector tokens?
I wish that it was two at a time. I think that most of the frustration and most of the problem with these is that they happen one at a time. I think literally just by making that one a two, you create a game that makes a lot more sense for people.
For my part, I don't necessarily feel the same way. It's I understand Glazer's point, and he's not entirely wrong, but I do like the fact that they rotate it and have three in a day. If you check it different times, you check in the morning and then, you know, in the afternoon to early evening, and then before you go to bed, you've got three shots at looking at new cards. And so when you have a situation like I just had, where you open your game and Adam Warlock is the offered card, it's like, well, there'll be something new at 8 in the morning tomorrow. So, or 6 in the morning, whatever.
6 in the morning, right when I wake up.
By the time I've woken up, there will be something new there. So there's an excitement level to that as well, I think, where it's like a miniature version of the cash opening experience.
It is, yeah, that's definitely the case. So the next question that Tom has for us is, will you think they ever pull down from pool three into pool two? I'm just going to quick answer. I think no, because I think pool two is a really curated experience that they clearly put like a lot of intentional work into what cards are in there and designed it. So with pool two, you can create a mid, but still very competitive deck with just pool two cards. And they aren't going to, like, I think they aren't going to add some pool three cards into pool two because of that curated experience. And they want you to have FOMO about expanding the sort of mid competitive deck into something explosive. But do you, either of you, disagree with that?
I think they will add a few cards. I think that rather than do that, what they should focus on, they, the most recent Thingamajig, the most recent update, had a lot of buffs in it. I think we would do better if instead of all these buffs, we had a lot more, Zola, and it made my brain break for a second. Instead of all these nerfs, we had some buffs for the weaker cards, the cards that are otherwise useless. If they were good, this would be a less feel bad thing within pool three for opening the crap, and I would not feel like I need these other cards as much.
I'm mostly with Glazer here, I think. I think there's a chance they could add cards to pool two, but I don't think it will be many. And I think, as Roy said, I agree that pool two is very curated. So I suspect they would be very careful about what cards they wanted to move from three to two. They would be more of these, like, maybe mid-tier cards that don't necessarily open up huge new archetypes that add something to a deck, but maybe they're replaceable a little later or the like, that sort of thing. But will there be a large scale? No, I don't think that's likely.
Cool. So I'll throw this to you, Aaron. How much or how many threats are you putting on each lane, and how many lanes are you trying to contest?
That's going to have to be its own episode, to be perfectly honest. I'm not trying to be mean in any way. I think that we would do better treating that as its own episode rather than making that a part of this episode entirely. How the answer is, I am almost always fake contesting all three and really contesting two.
Seems about right.
There's a lot of nuance that goes into this, and you know, we're still learning it as well. Like, it, I think it also depends on what kind of deck you're playing. Some decks are really good at power contesting two lanes. Some decks are better at putting up some resistance in all three. It's just going to be very deck and meta and opponent dependent, and it deserves a lot of time.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's just not one question that can be answered quickly.
Definitely one we're going to come back to. Speaking of one we're probably going to come back to as well, how do you do cost curves? Lavin, do you have anything you want to say about that?
Again, we'll go into more detail on this later, but I can talk in a general sense. If you're coming from something like Hearthstone, the most important thing to know is that staying on curve, and on curve is playing the card or playing cards that use all of your available energy or mana or whatever it is in your given game each turn. In Snap, that's less important, significantly less important. I run a fair number of decks that have either zero or one drop, for instance. Mm-hmm. Not all of them, but it's not uncommon for me to run no one drops or one drop. There are decks that don't run, there aren't many, but there are a few decks that don't run any one or two costs. Like, it really depends on what your deck is doing. And what's much more important is finding synergies between your cards and producing results that are going to be outsized above the sort of standard level of what the cards would produce.
I also think that.
No, go ahead, Roy.
I think that this is also a card game that requires finishers, like some big effect or preferably effects that go over the top of something. Like, Sarah is the most ridiculous example in the game currently, right? You know, the fact that she lets you play a bunch of cards. But it can even just be like a pretty powerful card like Hulk or Captain Marvel or America, right? These sort of like chonky folks who can put some power in a lane that you need to sort of go over the top of what your opponent did in a specific lane. Not like some card games, if you're coming from Magic or Hearthstone, like even a control deck, I'm saying, doing scare quotes right now for folks on the podcast, like needs some kind of effect that can close the game, because the game cannot go infinite turns in the case of Magic, or in Hearthstone, can the deck damage, right? There are 6 to 7 turns, that's all you get. And you need to have some sort of effect that closes. And so I would definitely make sure you have a finisher, like a 5 or a 6 drop that has a powerful effect or numbers. Blazer?
I think your deck is 12 cards, so you don't have to think about it at all the same way. It's a whole different paradigm because of the deck size and because of the extremely limited term limit number. It changes how you have to conceptualize things like control versus aggro and kind of everything else about how card games work in really interesting ways. I think ones either are utterly irrelevant, right? Or like crazy important, and there's very little in between for when and how you play a one. And I think that that's like super cool and interesting. Like, I can climb 20 levels today if I just played my pool one kazoo deck, the no onslaught version. Like, that deck is fantastic and it doesn't need any help or like struggle with anything really. Versus I can play a game that has zero ones. Like, the consistency of your game plan in this game is completely off the charts because you have 12 cards. So if you're playing a 2-card combo, like, you're going to see that 2-card combo in something like 60% of all games. And that is... Will just texted me and asked me for my address, sorry. That is going to change the way you have to conceive cost curves. In general, you want something like 2 sixes, 2 fives, 2 fours, and then you fill it out with 3s and 2s. But, like, there's such wild variation, just even in the decks we talked about today. And, like, those are built around 3-drops entirely because of Silver Surfer. That, like, you can do so many different things, it's really hard to answer. But I strongly urge people to get used to Snap.fans deck search function. It is extraordinarily useful looking at how people have done it. You can check win percentage, which is also very helpful.
The nice thing about that SnapFan deck search engine as well is you can add looking for decks with specific cards in them, but excluding other cards in them. So mm-hmm. if you've seen a deck out there and you're like, wow, that looks really good, but I don't have Magneto, you could plug in, you know, a couple key cards from the deck you do have and then exclude Magneto and see what other people have done with that particular restriction.
Yeah, that's very cool. Like, very well, the next question is nice and simple. Is Quicksilver good?
No.
No. I don't think Quicksilver is good, but I think a Domino is decent. You want to talk about the math, Chris?
Yeah, there's videos out here about the math. So I encourage you to go look up videos on math on YouTube for Snap. Basically, Domino makes it like, on average, it's something like 3 to 5% less likely of seeing any particular card at different draw slots in your deck. The reason she's a little bit better than Quicksilver is because she'll appear on two, and she's got a better stat line, ultimately. You know, it's 2-3, and math, I think, is a little different there, too, but I think Quicksilver's math is a bit worse. But again, I encourage you, there are people who have done out these numbers exactly, and I encourage you to check them out. Related to that, America Chavez is generally good because the only time America Chavez is bad is if there are cards you really, really could use to draw on turn six that obviously America gets in the way of. But she makes your deck much more consistent in the five turns prior, which is where you want to build a lot of your combos and synergy. So that is why, again, long and the short, America Chavez is good, but Domino is questionable and Quicksilver is bad.
I agree with everything you just said.
Full agreement. How many six costers? How do we evaluate them? This is definitely another sort of big picture question, but maybe we'll stick on sort of the first question. So how many six costers should most median decks have?
1 to 2 in a general sense. There are a few decks out there. There aren't many, but there's a few that play 4 or even 5. In general, if you're building a deck, play 1 to 2, see how it works. You can modify from there.
Yeah. Then we're closing on the end here. We'll just sort of take the featured locations. Sort of, there's several questions that were asked about featured locations. What do we think about them? So, like, what is our personal sort of TLDR about how to deal with feature locations? Do we like them? Do we not like them? How do we change our deck building strategies?
So I don't love feature locations, although we have a new one now that seems quite cool. I don't love feature locations. I don't love that it's 40% of games. There tends to be a meta deck for each location, and I don't like that very much. I prefer to be able to kind of play whatever I want. And like, there's a meta deck and you end up either playing one of those like one or two meta decks for this location, or the hard counter to the meta deck for that location. And that's not really what I want to be doing. I guess there's nothing for that. That's exactly what these, are designed to do. And so it is what they succeed at doing, right? Like, they are asking you to like make a concession for a day to 2 days. When it's 24 hours, it's far less better than when it's 48. But I often just find myself doing my dailies and not trying too hard for those couple days, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't like how often they happen, fundamentally. Also, if you are hearing this soon, if Roy gets this up soon, the location currently is called, I'm going to try and pronounce this, is called Lamentis 1, and you should really be playing Death Decks.
It's insane. It's going to be so wacky. Yeah. What I would say is I generally agree with Glazer that feature locations feel, and again, this is a feel thing, I'm not disputing the math, they feel like they come up more often than 40% of the time, which is sort of an indication that maybe it's a little too often, like, because it kind of feels bad. I agree that there generally tends to be one, maybe two meta decks, and then a counter deck. I play the counter deck because I am too cool for school in that regard, and don't want to play the deck everybody's playing, unless it's a really up-my-alley deck. So you can, you are not bound to play one deck, but I would say if you're not playing one of, like, you might have three or four viable decks at a location, and if you're not, you're probably going to struggle some with the featured locations. They will pass. You can still win games, even if you're not playing the deck to take advantage of the featured location. But I would say you've got to be better about identifying what the opponent's playing and knowing, I can't beat this deck at this location right now. They've gotten their pieces, and retreating out. So you can do something different. Just be prepared to retreat more often. And that's, I don't know, it's okay. I agree with Glazer that 24 hours would be significantly better. I find the 24-hour ones, no matter how much I hate the location, to be entertaining, because it's a little, like, you know, mix-up, a little puzzle, as Aaron was saying. 48 hours feels so long, because, like, if the location just isn't clicking with you, you're like, okay, I'm going to play exactly as many games as I need to not have my dailies cap, and that's it. And you don't, I don't think that's a good thing you want your player base to be feeling.
Absolutely. But my advice is also, as always, as I say, students, think about your goals. And if your goal is to hit infinite, then yes, you've got to play the deck, the counter decks, the proper decks. If it's not, if it's just sort of experience snap or whatever level you're in, just ignore it. Like, don't play in that lane. As Chris said, retreat if it's out of control. Just move on. One of the greatest things about snap is it's easy to just move on to the next game. More than Hearthstone, more than Arena, Magic Arena, you can just click the red button and you have a game within 5 more seconds and it's a new set of experiences. So if you hate the location, just snap concede every game that is there. Like, just move on. The cost is very low. So final question, speaking of snapping, what do we think about newer players and sort of snap strategy? What might be a good place for them to start?
So in the fan mail, Tom suggested, he offered the suggestion that he thinks new players should not worry about snapping at all. And I think I mostly agree with him on that. I think until you're into maybe your 30s, or you feel comfortable in terms of rank, or you feel comfortable with the game, don't worry about snapping too much early. Only do it if you feel like you need to get the experience of, like, what it's like. If you're being overwhelmed by trying to figure out what cards do or what combos do, or trying to figure out what decks people play, then don't worry about it. Just learn the basics. But once you're comfortable with the basics, then you start snapping. And what I would tell you is, for the first, I don't know, 20, 30 games you snap in, don't worry about if you win or lose. Like, it'll just tell you, you'll get a better sense of whether to snap or not. Like, you're going to have games where you snap, the opponent snaps, you're convinced you're going to win, and you're going to lose 8 cubes. It's just going to happen. It's okay. So develop that once you're comfortable, is what I would say.
Awesome. So if you are like our good friend, Tom Bentley, friends out there, you can send us fan mail too. We're working on getting additional socials, which should hopefully be up over this winter. But right now, our email is open at snapjudgmentspodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's snapjudgmentspodcast@gmail.com. I want to thank Aaron and Chris for joining me today. But before we head out, we have our sort of second snaps, you could say, of sort of recommendations of what we are doing beyond Marvel Snap, or some experience or fun thing that we'd like to share with you, our listeners. I think Chris and I are simpatico about what we're doing right now. So
yeah, I'm gonna start with Blazer.
I'm going to start with Aaron.
We're going to go.
So I'm going to recommend Wednesday. I don't love it, but I like it enough to recommend fairly highly. My big complaint is Wednesday should probably be Ace, not Into Dudes. She's always been like a queer icon, and that she's seemingly straight, at least thus far into the show, is a little off-putting. However, I think the show is otherwise kind of delightful. It's definitely in the vein of like a Riverdale, except it's just better and better made, and I'm really enjoying it. So that's my...
All right. Chris, why don't you go ahead and say, I'll throw it to you.
All right. So since its release on Friday, I have played nothing but Marvel Midnight Suns, and it is bonkers good. Like, I was stunned at how much I liked it. It is a tactical RPG, but using card deck systems, kind of like Slay the Spire, with a splash of Divinity Original Sin thrown in for combo effects and the like. It's got some of the characters you would expect to see, because it's Marvel and they've got to sell the game, so they need the featured characters that everybody knows. But it also has some lesser known characters, including a couple of my absolute favorites, with Magic and Nico Minoru.
Oh, yeah.
It's Nico. So good. It like has blown my mind how good this is. I have spent basically every free hour playing it that I can. I will likely go back to playing it for an hour or so before bed after we get done with this. It's unbelievably good.
Yeah, it's the combat is very XCOM meets Slay the Spire. You have three hero teams, so it's usually like your Avatar hero and two Marvel heroes. Like, so example, right before we get on here, I was definitely not playing Iron Man and Spider-Man and my hero grinding some stuff. I like this game is like personally designed for me. Like, if I feel exploited, because it's basically Fire Emblem meets Marvel. So like your stand-in Avatar character, the Hunter, befriends all of the Marvel heroes, like, and does like Three Houses style interactions with them. So you can be bros with Tony Stark, you can be bros with Ghost Rider, you can joke around with Spider-Man, all things that I have done in Marvel Midnight Sun. I'm like, this is like, I'm just gonna get, my life is gonna get absorbed by this game. Like, I already feel it happening. And I haven't even gotten past like the seventh story mission, because I just keep doing grinding. One complaint is there's too many currencies in the game. This is like I was complaining about my wife. There's like just like seven different currencies you have to manage, and I don't like that. It sort of gates the game in like weird ways that I don't enjoy. We could talk more about this. This will become a Midnight Suns podcast, and we keep going. But yeah, Chris, you want to say one more thing?
Yeah, it's worth mentioning that this is designed, if you care about developers at all, and you know, often people do, this is designed by Firaxis, who are the people that did the redesign of XCOM back maybe 10 years ago now.
Don't kill me like that, Chris. 10 years. Jesus.
Something like that. I'd have to look up the exact. But it's so it's done by people who have strategic RPG chops. And it shows. It shows. It's not the same kind of game as XCOM exactly. It's got similarities. You can see the DNA there, but it's got splashes of a bunch of other types of games, and this is what they're good at, and they continue to be good at it.
Absolutely. If you're the kind of person who's playing Marvel Snap and if you like RPGs, this is definitely a game that you should check out. So that sort of, again, brings us to the end of this episode. Glazer, thank you in the middle of the Marvel Snap game you are playing right now. Thank you for joining me today.
You're welcome. And I am in the middle of the world's that game. How did you know?
Oh, it's not like I've been podcasting with you for almost a decade. Lavin, thank you for joining me as well.
Of course. Happy to be here. Thanks, Ron.
All right, folks. So again, if you need to reach out to us, our email is snapjudgmentpodcast@gmail.com. Oops, excuse me, snapjudgmentspodcast@gmail.com. And we will see you soon to talk more about Pool 4 and Pool 5 cards and sort of where the card collection meta is right now. Until then, have a great week, stay safe, and keep on snapping.